This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Jinxie, Kristen, and Morgan. Thanks for your support, friends. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with the podcast.
And we all think that we have these really good bullshit detectors. But I listened back to tapes of Larry Nassar before he got caught. And my bullshit detector does not go off.
In Michigan Public Radio's Believed podcast, a monster abuses dozens of young women and blights American gymnastics. In 30 for 30's The Two Escobars, a monster murders thousands in the name of the drug trade and blights Colombian football. It's not a contest between Larry Nassar and Pablo Escobar, but if it were, we would all lose. In The Blotter Presents, episode 77. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast devoted to the principle that crime is bad, but some of the stories about crime can be really good. Speaking of that, it's really good of my guest to join me for this march of unrelenting grimness. Hello again, Stephanie Green.
Hi.
Yes, so let's just get right into it. Our most wanted section today is, as I noted, the Believed podcast from NPR and Michigan Public Radio. Here is the case file from the podcast's iTunes page, and forgive me in advance for any stumbles. That version of this that I clipped and put in our doc is like a orange four-point font on a navy blue background. I'm not sure how this is going to go.
It looks like the early internet.
It really does. slash Tilden or whatever the strings of numbers were for a CompuServe account. Good times. All right, here we go. How did Larry Nassar, an Olympic gymnastics doctor, get away with abusing hundreds of women and girls for two decades? Believed is an inside look at how a team of women won a conviction in one of the largest serial sexual abuse cases in U.S. history. It's a story of survivors finding their power in a cultural moment when people are coming to understand how important that is. It's also an unnerving exploration of how even well-meaning adults can fail to believe. And now a content warning for listeners. In the event that you're somehow unaware of the scope and nature of Nassar's crimes, Believed includes descriptions of sexual abuse that are explicit and upsetting. And we will be playing and discussing some of those descriptions. Some listeners may need to skip this section of the podcast, and if that's the case, we will talk to you in about half an hour. Okay, so Stephanie, I'm not going to say requested that we talk about this, but suggested that we discuss it. I had it in mind to do as a blotter brief, but I'm actually relieved to have another person to help me work through what we're hearing. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you discovered this podcast? Did you start listening right when it premiered?
Yeah, I did. I think it was advertised on Dr. Death, or maybe that's how I found out about Gladiator. I'm not sure. I feel like all these true crime podcasts sort of boost the other ones. And it's an it's a Michigan Public Radio podcast, so I might have heard about it on one of the NPR podcasts that I listen to. But anyway, that's so I got right on it. And I'm from Michigan, so there was that connection too. And I obviously, I mean, not obviously, but I had heard of Larry Nassar, and I knew about his connection with USA Gymnastics and Michigan State. So I thought it was interesting, and I don't think I was fully prepared for how disgusting this podcast would be and how disturbing. Like, I think when you hear about stuff like this in the news, you're like, oh, serial sex abuse, that's terrible. But then when you listen to the actual stories, it's really tough. Maybe that sounds trite to put it that way, but it really, I mean, it brings a whole new level of disgustingness and horror to it when you're hearing individual people tell what happened to them. So Yeah, it is. I mean, it's very well made, but it's really tough to listen to.
It really is. There are a couple of times in the podcast when I feel like the hosts are Lindsay Smith and Kate Wells, and I feel like there are a couple of times sort of earlier in the podcast when I don't exactly know how to put this. I'll just play a quick clip in which they're sort of not joking, but let me play the clip and then I'll try to explain what I'm talking about.
By age 6, they know which kids have it and which ones don't. And by the time you're out of college, your body is just done, man. You are Brett Favre doing infomercials.
It's not that that like rubbed me the wrong way or anything. It's not terrible, but sometimes the hosts can have this sort of classic NPR, almost amused tone.
Glibness, is that the word you're looking for? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I would attribute it more to, like, if it were me, I would feel almost nervous and kind of anticipating what is to come in future episodes in terms of the bracing, wrenching content. And mm-hmm. I might be a little, you know, trying to either leaven the proceedings with a little like jokey comparison like that, or I don't know. It's difficult to describe, but there are a couple of tone moments that mm-hmm. don't completely work for me early in the proceedings that I, you know, I'm going to sort of assume were just nerves or needing to not have the same kind of grim tone the entire time. I don't know if I'm doing a good job explaining this or if anyone else agrees yeah. with me, but at times the narration early on is it's like on the verge of amused, and it doesn't quite work for me. But except for that, and especially when they get into the meat of it, ugh, for lack of a better term, I think it's very well done. Have you done any auxiliary reading about why NPR or the hosts decided to make this podcast at this point?
I haven't. No, I'm not sure.
I haven't either, and I'm interested. You know, I might include some links in the show notes if I can find anything that speaks to that, because as we're recording this, and as, you know, as of when this podcast began, Nassar had already been sentenced to a gazillion years
right.
in prison. So I, you know, part of me wonders if this is not about sort of testimony, which I think is fine, but sort of a cultural testimony to what survivors of Nassar went through and the importance of listening and believing. And if that was their only motivation, I'm here for that. I also think that they're very skillful at explaining why they're doing certain things in terms of the narrative build. For example, they make a point of calling him Larry and not Nassar, Dr. Nassar, which I don't think they could anymore. Here is an explanation from, I think, episode 3 of why they're doing that.
By September 2004, Larry is back at his normal job on clinical duties at Michigan State University's Sports Medicine Clinic. And just as a reminder, we're calling him Larry because it's important to think about him not as Nassar, the guy you saw on the news, but as Larry, the trusted, beloved, goofy doctor. Everyone called him Larry.
Yeah, I thought that was an excellent point, that there were a bunch of sort of, I don't know, failure of institutions reasons that this guy continued to prey on, you know, 150 young women mm-hmm. for years on end. And one of them, you know, one of them was the failure of him as a, you know, but also the like creepy success that he enjoyed making himself seem both authoritative and friendly and, you know, familial.
Yep.
Ugh. But another one of the failures was not all parents, but one set of parents in particular. Episode 4, we hear from, which is called The Basement. Very, very effective title, is about one young woman's horrible journey with Nasser, who is a family friend of her parents, abusing her starting when she was 6 years old. Her finally realizing at age 12 that what he was doing was not a, you know, a game and was not okay, and telling her parents, and for various reasons of their own, I think her father was ill at that time and whatever else was going on, her parents deciding not only that they didn't believe her, but that she would have to recant. Or, well, let's hear clip 4.
Her parents' doubts wear her down. They fight about it all the time.
One day, I was sitting on the floor in my living room in front of the TV, and my dad looked down at me and said, "If you don't tell the truth, I'm going to make your life a living hell." And I believed him. I saw his face, and I knew he meant it. And if I was not already in a living hell, I was underprepared to endure one. And he saw me break just in my face. He must have seen it, because he said, "Are you ready to tell the truth?" And I said, "Yup." And he said, "So you were lying?" And I said, "Yup."
I
could not believe that story with the parents. I mean, this child was abused for years and years and years, and then she finally gets up the courage to tell her parents, and they not only don't believe her, but actively choose to remain friends with Larry Nasser and his wife, and actually make their daughter continue to babysit for the Nassers, even after she told them that he was molesting her. I mean, it's like, it boggles the mind. Like, you know, you're not supposed to say anyone's a bad parent. Those are bad parents. Like, they're horrible.
Yeah, they are. And there was a moment, like, I think just before this, they had said that for a year, they didn't hang out with the Nassers, the parents. So this is what makes it really unforgivable to me. Like, if you're just not worldly about these things or in denial, like, that's still not really forgivable, but it's comprehensible. And there is a consistency of worldview there, but the way these parents behaved, which is that on some level they knew it was true, and then they proactively decided basically to gaslight their child.
Yep.
And to just be like, everyone's life will be much easier if you just say that you're lying about this, even though on some level we know you're telling the truth, and then we'll just continue exposing you.
It's ridiculously messed up. And it's amazing. It's like double traumatizing to her. She was a victim of sexual abuse and then also lost her parents, basically, because they didn't support her. It's crazy.
And on top of that, like, there's all these levels of this, which are all, you know, terrible and unacceptable. But to not just be like, "I don't believe you," but if you don't admit that you're lying, I, your parent, your male parent, for, you know, who is modeling this behavior for you will like torture you, basically.
Yeah.
And how old was she at this point? 13?
Yeah.
Great, great job, parents.
Jeez.
Like, you know, we'd all like to think that we would do the right thing in this situation, and it's easy. I think I wrote this in the context of the Sandusky thing at Penn State, but like, it's easy when you're in the subjunctive, it's easy to be a superhero.
Sure.
And I certainly don't love judging parents who are in this situation, but I have no problem doing it with these parents.
Yeah. And as a parent, I can say if my child told me that someone was hurting them, I would unconditionally believe my child. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't go out and like file a police report right away. I'd ask questions, but like, you know, your job as a parent is to protect your kid no matter what. So that's, I mean, it's unfathomable to me how anyone could do this.
And like, why would your first, I just don't understand, I guess, why your first instinct would be to believe the grown-up dude who always volunteers to play hide-and-seek with the kids. Like,
so creepy.
I just feel like that would have at least a hackle.
Right,
like, you know, that it's like, okay, once or twice to take the weight while we have a glass of wine, and like, great, thank you. Every weekend?
Yeah, and he must have been down there for a while too. I mean, that's what is weird too about the parents. Like, weren't they questioning, hey, why has Larry been in the basement for 20 minutes by himself with these kids? Like, it's so, you know?
Yeah.
For me, that would be off. I don't think that's ever happened. And all the times where we've had play dates with parents, you know?
Yeah. I don't, that's just weird. And then you're like not, you're sort of not hearing any sounds coming from the basement. Like, kids are usually not that quiet. I mean,
no.
I don't know. The whole thing is just very strange.
Yeah.
To me.
Me too.
The podcast does a good job sort of stacking up. And as you're listening to this, I think another episode has now aired that Stephanie and I have not heard yet. Stephanie, do you know how many episodes this is meant to
no,
be total?
I don't.
I think there are a couple more.
I get that sense.
Yeah.
Because they haven't even gotten to the trial or anything yet.
Right. But they do a good job assembling sort of the case for how, not only how this happened, how Nassar did this and how Nassar could continue doing this. They do a good job assembling all the institutional and interpersonal reasons why. And they also do a great job focusing on his particular MO in terms of not just how he perpetrated the literal abuse, but how he managed to explain it away to authorities multiple times. And in one episode, they kind of slice up the account from one survivor and then his account to police, so that you have each version side by side, point by point, and you can see how he explains these things away. And they make a point of explaining that that's what they're doing, that they're like, oh, we're still here. We just want this to run for a while so that you can see how he gaslighted everyone. And I think that's the name of the episode. And the clip that we're about to hear, it's not all that explicit, but the term mentoring made me want to vomit on the R train while I was listening to this. So here is clip 5.
We want you to hear Larry and Amanda's stories side by side.
30 minutes is the quickest appointment that you're gonna have with me.
But it was like a 2-hour, 3-hour appointment.
It's 30 to 60 minutes, okay? Because I do a lot of hands-on and I do a lot of mentoring. You know, I do a lot of talking.
Ugh.
mentoring.
So gross.
And I mean, well, let me ask you this. Do you, I mean, we have the benefit of hindsight. We know what he is. We know what he did. We know what became of him as a result. So I'm not sure it's fair of me to hear what he's saying and be like, that's obvious horseshit. But it does seem like obvious horseshit to me, some of it. Did it seem that way to you, or were you sort of more?
I don't know. I'd like to think yes. But listening to this podcast made me think about, so I've done sport, like organized sports my whole life. I mean, until, you know, I was an adult, but, and I did, some competitive, like figure skating for 8 years, and which is not the same as gymnastics, but sort of a similar vibe.
Sure.
And then I ran cross country, and I was on a swim team, and I did track. And it's like, whenever you're in these like high impact, like very hard on the body, very competitive sports that involve traveling and getting injured, and in some cases being part of a team, you do have, like, you end up, A, spending a lot of time with coaches, like, where maybe no Sure. one is supervising, and B, putting your trust in experts who, like, for example, I fractured my femur when I was in high school from Oof. An overuse injury, because that was the kind of cross-country team I was on. And Jeez. I had to go to, not, I went to the University of Michigan Sports Medicine Clinic, actually. Not Michigan State. And, you know, you're examined and you're put through exercises and you see all these different doctors and physical therapists and whatever. And I had to have bone scans and all this stuff. And then you just have to kind of put your blind faith in whatever adult man usually is trying to help you. And I think, especially for kids whose parents don't have like a medical background, like, you're just going to believe what a doctor tells you. And if the doctor tells you, listen, this particular thing is necessary therapeutically, unless you have a reason to doubt them, you're going to believe them and trust them. And you want your kid to get better. And a lot of these gymnasts who were seeing Larry Nassar were injured. And I'm sure their parents just wanted their children to heal. You know, that's the impulse behind bringing your child to Larry Nassar, unless, of course, you're Kyle's parents, where it's just like a social thing.
Right.
And you're evil and a terrible parent. So it's like, I totally understand how parents were hoodwinked by him.
Sure.
And I mean,
he did this to hundreds of people, and sometimes with the parents in the room.
In the room.
Like, I think that's what
today's episode is about, the one that just dropped that we haven't listened to yet. I think it's interviewing parents who actually unwittingly witnessed their children being abused by Larry Nassar. And it sounds so horrifying, and how could that even happen? But like, I think the aura, the medical aura, like, you're a doctor, you're sure. the trusted figure, goes really far in like just assuaging people's fears and maybe turning off that voice in their head that's like, well, is that appropriate? Well, it must be, because surely no doctor who's going to actually abuse my child would be brazen enough to do it in front of me, A. And yeah, B, like, exactly. This guy's the most respected doctor in this particular field. Like, I'm going to trust him. So, yeah.
And he's still getting recommendations, like, compared to the guy who was the subject of the last podcast we spoke about, like, you know, that guy, you're sort of like, really? You're getting recommendations? But Nassar was like the top name in the field. Presumably he did actually help some people medically without touching them inappropriately. Possibly not. But it, yeah, there's part of me that's like, I mean, I don't judge any of the survivors at all. And with, you know, Kyle's parents, whatever, kick rocks. But most of the parents who were in the room, he had a whole system for how to do this. And because you're in the room, you're like pattern recognition for situations is not going to be suspicious.
Yeah.
Of what he's doing. Like, maybe if you are the parent of an athlete who has been injured and you have been to enough doctor's appointments, maybe you find it a little weird that he's not wearing gloves.
Yeah.
And I would find it, like, just to go to the dermatologist to get moles checked.
They wear gloves.
Yeah, he wears gloves, and there's always a woman, like, nurse practitioner in the room. Because that's the law.
Is it?
And I've been going to, I mean, I think in New York State it is.
It's not.
I've been going to this guy half my life. And it's, I mean, he would never be inappropriate, but having someone else in the room. And certainly with minors, you would think that would be de rigueur. But I don't, you know, again, this is absolutely not victim blaming. I'm more talking about, like, once he is reported, that detective, that first detective that we hear from is a little more, I guess, willing to accept not only that this is mentoring, but that he's also massaging the pelvic floor for, like, a neck injury, which, okay, like, I know everything's connected, but, you know, give me a fucking break. And also put some gloves on. Shit.
Oh, it's so disgusting.
Oh, my God. And then I think the upshot of that first investigation is that they insisted that he wear gloves and have someone else in the room, but they didn't follow up to make sure he was doing that, so he didn't. And then our next clip, I believe, showcases a similar,
this is the one I picked. Yeah.
This, all right. Again, content warning. This is, this is a roof one.
I tell people the touch is a personal thing, but there's a difference between palpation and caressing. You know what I mean? There's a total different, like, I tell a story, this is a true story, about when I was dating in medical school. And the reason why I went to DO school was for the hands-on stuff. And it ended shortly thereafter because we'd be intimate together and she'd say, "You're palpating again," because I'm like, "But I can fix this." Right. You know what I mean? And so I was like, you know, so I was more in tune, and that's how I've made my reputation, is very in tune to the person's body.
Ugh.
Sorry. Everything about that is vile.
What's so stomach turning about it, listening to it from our vantage point, is that, I mean, he's clearly trying to be charming, right? Like, this is the shtick that's worked for him for years and allowed him to, like, get away with this shit for so long. But now that he's, like, we know that he's guilty and we can, like, we know what he's done, and hearing it in that context, it's like, you are so disgusting. Like, I just don't even... It's like your little, like, charming, you're palpating again. It's like, ugh.
Oh, my God.
I can't even be articulate about it because it's just so disturbing.
I know. And just, like, there's certain words that have been completely ruined by the experience of this podcast. I can never be a mentor. I can never palpate anything.
Michigan accents for you yet?
Yep. So that's literally an entire branch of my family that, okay, I'm going to need 6 months.
You're estranged from them now.
Yeah. Like, texting only, please.
Yeah.
All y'all cousins. Yeah. Sorry, guys. Oh, and that's another part of it too, that accent reads to me personally, very,
folksy.
Familially, and a little folksy, but also folksy people who I know from like going to the VFW in Bloomfield Hills, like,
that's which right where I'm from.
Yeah, you've probably driven right past it. Yeah, like, really killed the whole state. Okay. Yeah, I mean, but again, it's very effective, the clips that they choose to use. And again, this is the I believe this is from the interview from the first report.
Yeah.
That he managed to talk his way out of. But
yeah, that went nowhere, right?
Yeah, because he had, I mean, he had his fucking PowerPoint.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, lights, please, click. And it's like, all right, well, it didn't occur to anyone that he has a PowerPoint set up in his defense. That might ring a, you know, ring a little bad bell for me. But by the time the second report is made, this detective is not having his shit. And we'll hear that in clip 7. And again, this description is sugar free.
Your fingers are vaginally penetrating her.
What?
And then your thumb anally penetrated her.
No.
So I don't see where that falls in line with that technique.
Right, and I don't see how that would be accurate.
More than once, or more than one treatment.
I'm just working the floor, you know what I mean? But I would not be, how would I be putting my thumb in and fingers, you know, like that? That would not be correct. You know what I mean? I am.
Now, if there's some type of treatment.
Notice what Detective Munford is doing here. She is nailing Larry down on specifics. Now she has got him on the record denying that he penetrates patients.
And she is not buying Larry's story.
Mm-hmm. The words that she used were he anally penetrated me with his thumb.
No, see, that wouldn't have been, see, I would never do that for the coccyx. I would use my, if I'm going inside, I'm using this. If I'm penetrating, it's not penetrating, it's pushing off to the side.
Well, I penetrated her. Okay. What you're describing to me is very different than how she's describing her experience.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
That there was an explanation of what you were doing to her or to her mother. And so you can see kind of the consistency from what happened a couple years ago.
Well, no, but okay. But I mean, okay. I'm.
Larry is sweating. He wipes his forehead. His right leg starts bouncing.
It's when he says and yeah, like 17 times that I was like, and, you know, you burnt. And good for this detective, very methodically making him commit to a story and then being able to pick it apart. And good for the podcast for very clearly laying out, like, this is what you're hearing. This is why it's important. I know I criticized the hosts earlier for that kind of and like public radio-y tone that maybe was kind of sitting on top of the content and not integrating with it, but when they get into the really serious tough stuff, I think they do an excellent job illustrating it and also not building in breaks exactly, but kind of occasionally coming into the story and giving you some context and also giving you a break from him.
Right.
So on balance, you know, that little critique aside, I think this is really well done. And I think it's sort of important to hear this testimony and to hear how important it is to hear from survivors and to listen to people and especially children.
Yeah. it's just,
and now we're going to take a break for an ad from the Lie Council, in which I'll be bathing myself.
Right.
Yeah. Ooh, I mean, yeah, I thank you for bringing this to the table today, but I'm not going to be super sorry that the podcast is over. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, thank you for, you know, listening to it and talking about it with me, because I, like you, needed someone to talk to about it. So
yes, listeners, if you need to have a little social media interaction therapy about this podcast, Blotter Presents on both Twitter and Facebook, and we are here for you. I thought our cold case would be a little bit lighter in tone.
Uh.
it really is all relative. I thought that I would select a case that was also about sport, 30 for 30, that somehow I had not seen, possibly because it's about soccer. It's called The Two Escobars. It is from 2010, the first group of 30 for 30s in 2010. I can't believe that was almost 10 years ago. Yikes.
Wow.
Here is the case file. Andres Escobar was the super talented savior of Colombian soccer in the late 80s and early 90s. Pablo Escobar was, well, you know. Despite the name, they weren't related, but their names will likely be twinned forever, thanks to their respective faiths in the run-up to the 1994 World Cup and immediately afterwards, and thanks to 30 for 30's 2010 film exploring, quote, narco soccer, and how Colombia's other national game pervaded every aspect of the country's cultural life. I did not know anything about this story. I watched all of the first three seasons of Narcos, so I knew something about Pablo Escobar, but I didn't know anything about Andres Escobar, and I think it is a credit to this 30 for 30 that I did not give in and Google him until afterwards. Stephanie, how much did you know about any of this story before we watched this?
Nada. Like, really nothing.
Okay. We don't have a ton of clips from this just because I don't know how good everyone else's Spanish is, but most of this film is subtitled pretty well as far as I could tell. But if you're not fluent, you know, as listeners, that's not going to do much for you. This one was a little bit longer than perhaps either of us soccer non-fans might have hoped. I don't want to speak for you.
I have in my notes, could have done without all the soccer. I understood that it was like necessary to the story at certain points, especially during the World Cup scenes. But before that, when they were just like showing clips of Colombian soccer, I'm like, okay, can we cut like 20 minutes of this out and just move along?
I mean, I did enjoy, I thought it was good for someone who doesn't know that much about the game, except, you know, put ball in net. Like, that's right. That's about the extent of my soccer knowledge. I thought it was about the right, it was pitched at about the right level. And I think generally that's the gift of 30 for 30, is that it can make you care about sports that you don't care about. Like, I happily sit through all these like pro wrestling ones because I'm like, all right, well, it's 30 for 30 and they'll bring me along in terms of what I need to know.
Yeah.
And as well, there was some really glorious hair on the 80s and early 90s Colombian soccer team, not least Andres Escobar's, I mean,
mullet.
Talk about, like, it was very businesslike in the front, and then it was a huge party in the back.
That haircut was not limited to the 80s and 90s in Latin America. I will just say that.
Okay.
Might still be around for all I know, but when I studied abroad in Chile, and that was, like, I'd say the number one most popular haircut among, like, every Chilean man I've ever seen, like, including actual businessmen.
Wow. Okay.
So, I mean, sure. It's a thing. It's a thing. It kind of, I got a little nostalgic looking at that hair for South America.
Oh, but did you feel that the documentary was effective at this length? And also, did you feel that the proportions of each Escobar were effective within the documentary?
Hard to say. I thought it was a little long. Like I said, I didn't really love all the soccer in the beginning. Later, it was more necessary to telling the story. And I didn't, I mean, I understand why it was the length it was, because there's so much story to tell. It's very complex. I mean, they're telling the story of the Colombian national soccer team in the 90s, but you can't tell that story without going into like the political situation in Colombia, the drug trafficking situation in Colombia, how both of those things influenced soccer and how soccer influenced both of those things. Then you go to the World Cup situation and what was happening in Colombia versus what was happening in the US, which is where the World Cup was happening. And then what happened when they went back to Colombia. So I get why it's as long as it is, but it did feel long. It was 2 hours. And maybe also because it was in Spanish. I don't know if that added to it as well. Because I speak Spanish, but I still wanted to like read the subtitles. You know what I mean? So I had to like look at it the whole time.
Yeah, same.
Which maybe that says something damning about my attention span, but... I think it could have been 90 minutes, to be honest.
I think so too. And I was okay with the soccer because I know little enough about the sport that it was like, all right, just, you know, hold my hand here so that I understand what's important for context later. But because I have watched Narcos and I did just, listen to an episode of that podcast Kingpins, and I feel like I know what I need to know in terms of Pablo Escobar's aspirations to be this man of the people who was like building schools, building apartment buildings, trying to run for the national assembly, trying to go legit, trying to like the fact that soccer teams are excellent money laundering operations, which is something that they did a good job explaining in this documentary.
Yeah.
I felt those parts were a little long, and I also think that the, you know, the Colombian drug cartels are sufficiently complicated and difficult to like really convey what a scourge some of these wars could be just within Colombia. And then when the United States, by both creating a market and then demanding that it be shut off, gets involved, and you can't separate that this is like a PhD level sociological treatise that they're trying to fit into an hour and 45 minute documentary about soccer.
I almost feel like it would have been better as a miniseries because, you know, then you could have gone more in depth into each of these aspects of the story without trying to stuff it all into one narrative. And I actually, you know, I would have wanted to know a little bit more about Andrés Escobar because he just came off as like kind of a one-dimensional, like, angel from heaven, you know what I mean? Like, they only showed the good sides of this dude. Like, he was a wonderful boyfriend, he loved his family, he was nice to all his teammates, he like cared about his community, and then he was, spoiler alert, murdered because he scored an own goal during the World Cup, and when he got back to Colombia some people were like taunting him about it, and then he ended up being murdered over it. I would have wanted to know more about him because I feel like there's probably more there that, wasn't totally explored in this documentary. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I still have, like, not to be whatever the Andres truther about the situation, but I got the feeling, I mean, it was slowly becoming clear as you got up to like the World Cup and then the own goal, it was slowly becoming clear, like, we've heard from his, you know, fiance, we've heard from his sister, we've heard from everybody else on the Colombian national team. And they do this in documentaries sometimes where it's like, in case you still haven't like gone on Wikipedia to see what's up with this person, here he or she is. But it was becoming clear that that was not going to happen. I still did not Google, but the way they were talking about it in terms of like the way they were losing at the World Cup and the nature of the like death threats that they were getting and the talking heads that were talking about how much money had been bet on the matches and stuff like that, I was like, was he bought?
Yeah, that's, I'm not sure.
Because they had made a point of saying throughout, like, Pablo Escobar was like braided himself in with these teams, and when he sort of announced that he would be going to prison and then took over a prison and ran it, he would bring the national team to come play soccer with him. And they made a point to say Andres did not want to do it, but understood that there wasn't really a choice involved. So I kind of wondered, based on the way they were talking about that, it seemed like the Molloy had been brought onto the team at the beginning of the World Cup, and how rare it was that he would, like, this own goal was like almost impossible to even do. And it's like, all right, so what are you saying? Like, is he an angel, or had he been bought and then they didn't get what they paid for?
Yeah. I don't know.
It was a little mysterious. Certainly, Pablo Escobar tended to get what he paid for. I wanted to play this clip in which a relative of Pablo's is saying rather cheerily, like sort of making a joke about the lengths Pablo would go to ensure wins for Colombian soccer.
My uncle, he wouldn't kill somebody to win a soccer game. Pablo Escobar would kill anybody to win a soccer game. That was the difference between Cartel of Cali and Cartel of Medellin. Pablo Escobar was more powerful because he was more bloody. He threatened everybody and say, National wins or everybody will be dead. That was it, and National won. Pablo Escobar did his job.
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah.
I guess. And then in the next clip, we have a retired DEA agent named, in my notes, I kept writing down Tom Ford. That's a very different documentary. No, his name is Tom Cash, which is also kind of an awesome name in context. But he's just talking about, it makes an interesting parallel with how a monster is allowed to flourish. It's a very different kind of monstrosity, but, you know, as Cash puts it, like, drugs were his business, and business was good for everybody in clip 9.
In Colombia, soccer was a religion. It was sacred ground. And in the Drug Enforcement Administration, we tracked traffickers all over the world to soccer championships. But we were the only people that were connecting the dots. Everybody else was too caught up in winning to notice. People liked it so much that they started writing folk songs about how wonderful Pablo Escobar was. Never mind all of his money was earned from cocaine. We don't want to talk about that. It was speak no evil, see no evil completely. The rich and powerful gained wide acceptance. This flamboyant lifestyle of having helicopters, fincas, soccer teams. It was the economy, and everybody was happy because the restaurants were full, the bars were full. With Pablo, there was no recession.
Yeah, that sort of reminded me of that line in The Sopranos, that it was like, this, you know, our business is the only one that's recession-proof. Anyway, sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, I was curious, and I don't know if you got a better sense for this than I did, about, so clearly, I mean, Pablo Escobar was using soccer teams to launder money, and so were these other, like, cartel bosses. And
yeah.
And obviously the owners were in on this, because they had to be, the team owners and the coaches and stuff. But I guess the in Pablo Escobar's case, he actually bought the team, so he became the owner. But so it's fairly out in the open. But then I was confused. I mean, maybe this is just, like, I don't know, cynicism or whatever, but later the coach of the national team, Maturana, he was also the coach of the, I think it's called, like, Atletico or something. It's like some team that Pablo Escobar had bought.
Right.
Later there's a quote from that coach saying, like, oh, it hurts that the Colombian national team was always associated with drug trafficking. And it's just so unfair that was our reputation. It's like, dude, are you kidding? You said, and there was a quote earlier in the documentary from the coach saying, like, yeah, having this drug money allows me to get better players on my team. Like, this is why our team was able to succeed as much as it did, because of this money that was flowing in. So then when he was like, oh, our team got a bad rap and we're not associated with the drug traffickers, I'm like, yes, you are. Like, wasn't this totally out in the open?
Yeah. And it, certainly as of the World Cup, like when people are getting death threats and they're sort of like, we need to rehabilitate the image of our country through our soccer team, which is only as good as it is because of
drug money.
Drug money. But there's also a quote from him and like half a dozen other dudes from the team at the same time that were like, the fuck do you want us to do? Yeah. Which is totally fair. Like, the amount of footage that you're seeing of just like bombs going off in shopping plazas and, you know, Escobar's mugshots in which he's just smiling like, how you like me now? I mean, they did what they had to do to live.
Sure.
And in Andres Escobar's case, like, I don't know what the situation really was. And I think there's like a, you know, the agreed upon lie is that a couple of dudes taunted him at a nightclub. He got into it with them and he killed them. But I think we're supposed to understand that
he was killed
for the own goal. But like, he had a deal to go to, what's it, Milan?
Yeah.
To go to an Italian club.
Right.
So if you're Andres Escobar, it's like, let me just do what I have to do so that I can get the out of here.
Sure.
And like, just move to Italy and bring my whole family, and soccer can get me out of here. But in order to do that, there's, you know, there are tolls that you have to pay in this country in order to live. So I mean part of me almost wonders like how much those who were interviewed, and it really was almost everyone who was still alive, relevant to the story, how much they even then felt comfortable talking about what they thought really happened. Because it's not, you know, it's not like the situation has really gone away.
Yeah.
It's like, Colombia, we're all about coffee now. Like, okay.
I mean, the whole, like, I didn't really know much about political history in Colombia or anything, but when I watch this, I'm like, how the hell was Pablo Escobar ever allowed to serve in Congress? Like, he was in the Congress for a while, right?
I think so.
In the Colombian Congress. And then at some point he murdered like at least two political opponents in rapid succession. And then the government was like, oh yeah, actually drug trafficking is bad. Like, I mean,
yeah.
But he just got too blatant with the murdering.
But then they also, I think he murdered enough people close to other congressmen after he was like shamed out of the Congress.
Yeah.
That they voted basically under duress to reverse their policy on extradition. And then he was
right.
Like, all right, now I'll surrender myself. Like,
which is crazy.
Like, what? Just let him be in the Congress. He's already running
the country.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
So this made me like sad for and afraid for Colombians.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of what a good job Narcos did in making, or and the, that the actor playing Pablo Escobar did, making this an even a little bit sympathetic character who was just a like almost genocidally murderous thug who was in charge, and your only choice is to leave and go somewhere safe like Guadalajara. I don't even know.
God, I haven't watched Narcos.
Yeah, I recommend it. It's good.
Okay.
It's good, and you'll be seeing a lot of that that mullet that makes you so nostalgic. But I thought this was good too. I do agree with you though that I think if they took another run at it at more length, like OJ Made in America style, that it might be more effective to let both the stories breathe and also to explore, like, all right, what do we really think was going on with Andres?
Right. Yeah, I'd be interested in that.
Yeah. But as it is, sure. Okay. I learned some things and I was entertained and somehow in a film about soccer. Just kidding. Don't at me. Speaking of entertaining, Stephanie, where else may listeners entertain themselves with your work?
You can entertain yourself with my blog, stephanieearlygreen.com, and I'm on Twitter occasionally at ETEFFI.
Very good. Thank you for enduring this somewhat bleak two-pack.
Only somewhat.
only somewhat. I'm glad we could cheer things up with a series of horrible drug-related murders in Colombian soccer. Yay, us.
Yay.
Coming up in future Blotter Presents is, I'll be traveling, so I'm not exactly sure of my schedule, but look out for a review of the new season of Leah Remini's Scientology show, as well as some year-end best-of lists that I could use your help on. How, you ask? Here comes the outro with that very information. If you've got a tip for the Blotter Presents, you can find me on social. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. And that's also my Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents, where you can become an official Blotter tipster. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you could give me a 5-star review. If you don't like the podcast, please keep that to yourself. My guest has been Stephanie Green, and she's on Twitter at @ateffy. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.